Hi, my name is Greg Lauer, and this is the first in a series of podcasts about the book Illusions, subtitled The Adventures of a Reluctant Messiah, written by Richard Bach, who also wrote Jonathan Livingston's sequel. If you've ever been exposed to the book Jonathan Livingston's sequel, you know that Richard Bach has a really unique style of writing, where he's not necessarily writing so much as, in my opinion, channeling from the universe a number of lessons that we all need to know. And maybe they're in front of our face and we just don't see it. And then Richard has a way of making those things real proximate and making those things easy to grasp and easy to understand. And sometimes not so easy to understand at a conscious top of the brain level, but at a heart level, to where it's almost instinctive and you know it that you know it, but if somebody was to ask you to explain it, you really can't explain it necessarily without using the same visuals that he uses in the books and those kind of things. And the reason I picked the book Illusions to do a podcast on is a few years ago, somebody introduced me to the book when I was going through a really tough time in my life, and he pointed out to me that there's some things in this book that I need to hear. Some things I need to understand. So I picked up the book. I actually got it from Goodwill. I was willing to invest 30-something cents in this book that has become probably my favorite of all time. As a matter of fact, any time I'm around and I see the book now, I pick up as many copies as I can find, hold on to as many as I can find for myself, and then give away as many as I can find. Now, I would recommend, in fact, if you want to get the book, I'd recommend you either go to any local bookstore. They probably have it in the self-help section, if anything else. It's kind of a hard book to characterize and categorize, but usually it's my experience. I find it in the self-help section. Or you can actually go to just about any Goodwill thrift store and find it for 50 cents or less, usually. And well worth any amount of money you invest in the book. Okay, now how did Richard come to write this book? Is kind of an interesting story, and he includes that in an introduction. It appears that after Jonathan Livingston Seagull, he didn't want to have anything to do with writing again. In fact, he says he used to hear more than once after Jonathan Livingston Seagull was published, "Well, what are you going to write next, Richard? What's next?" And his answer was that, "I don't have to write anything next, not a word. All the books together have already said everything I had asked them to say." And then he goes on to come around with a little bit more of the story, saying, "I do not enjoy writing at all. If I can turn my back on an idea out there in the dark, if I can avoid opening the door to it, I won't even reach for a pencil. But once in a while, there's a great dynamite burst of flying glass and brick and splinters through the front wall, and somebody stalks over the rubble, seizes me by the throat, and gently says, 'I will not let you go until you set me in words on paper.' That's how I met Illusions." Now, to me, one of the most fascinating things about this book is you get the feeling it's autobiographical, that Richard is one of the main characters, one of the two main characters. The other main character is the Reluctant Messiah, at least one of the Reluctant Messiahs. His name is Donald Shimura. And as we go through the book together, you'll find out that Donald has a pretty unique way of teaching Richard or reminding him of what he already knew, which is kind of amazing, if you ask me, the way he couches things in there. Kind of the overall gist of the book. There are, let's say, two main characters. One of those is Richard himself, going around giving $3 biplane rides out in the Midwest. Just going around, finding an empty field, parking his plane out in the empty field, getting permission by a farmer to be there. Then going out and kind of showboating up in the sky so people from the town would come from all around. And he says he did this for a number of years, just kind of barnstorming after Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Doing it for real. So the feeling you get as you read is that he was there and did that, which is kind of neat. Now, when you first open the book, there's a little section that looks handwritten. It's actually, if I'm not mistaken, it's actually reproductions of his original notebooks when he started writing. When Richard started writing and had to set the idea down on paper. And normally I don't want to just sit around and read big sections of the book. But in this case, I think I will, because it really sets the stage for what we're going to be talking about. And maybe not read the entire thing right now, because the entire thing right now is several pages. It would take quite a bit. But one thing I did want to address right away before I even get there is the idea of reluctant Messiah. Many of us with a Judeo-Christian background are not very comfortable with the word Messiah being used in any context where we are the Messiah. Yeah, because we're trying to be respectful of our idea of who the Messiah really is and who the Messiah really was. That being in the person and the deity of Jesus Christ. But if you remember that the word Messiah means anointed one, I think the point Richard is making here is that God has anointed all of us. He's anointed all of us for the time and place that we choose. And he's anointed us to intersect with the lives of people that we intersect with. And we bring those people into our lives for whatever the reason, whether it's to learn something from them, to teach something to them, or just to be entertained by them. And that's a point that Don Shimoda makes later on as the book progresses. So just whenever you hear the term reluctant Messiah or Messiah or the we are the Messiahs, if you have a Jewish or Christian background, don't let that throw you. It's not at all trying to be sacrilegious or anything of that nature. He's using the term Messiah not as it applied to Jesus historically, literally, but he's using the term Messiah to mean anointed one, and in that context that we are all anointed ones in our own way. Okay. Now, in the pages that look handwritten, and they're grease smudged, and you'll see as we go through and talk about the biplane rides and how they were fixing the planes and so forth, how the grease smudges on those pages. And it looks like pages right off a legal pad. You'll see how those grease smudges seem to work out really, really nicely in setting a tone for the book. Well, it starts off with a number of paragraphs that are actually numbered as the way Richard wrote on this pad for this purpose was to number these paragraphs so that they were, number one, easy to follow, number two, sequential, number three, you can take each one individually and probably break it down for some little nugget. One of the coolest things ever, in my opinion, about this book is I've read it 5 times now, and every time I have learned a whole lot more from the book than I ever did before. And every time I go through, it's like a whole nother layer or a whole nother level or a whole nother strata of learning. And that just points out to me that I have grown since the last time I read the book. And it's one of those books where it's just rich with meaning, rich with context, and just plain rich with mastery concepts. So here we go. First paragraph. There was a master come unto the earth, born in the holy land of Indiana, raised in the mystical hills east of Fort Wayne. Now, most people wouldn't think of Indiana as a holy land, but I think the point you can grab from here pretty easily is that a master or a messiah can be from just about anywhere, no matter how humble the beginning. And that means whether it's in a manger, wrapped in swaddling clothes, or in the holy land of Indiana, raised in the mystical hills east of Fort Wayne. A master, a true master, can be from just about anywhere. It continues on, the master learned of this world in the public schools of Indiana, and as he grew in his trade as a mechanic of automobiles. And the point to me on that particular paragraph is we can learn from just about anywhere or any situation or any context that we find ourselves in. I think we can learn something from that. Okay, and it continues on. But the master had learnings from other lands and other schools from other lives that he'd lived. He remembered these, and remembering became wise and strong, so that others saw his strength and came to him for counsel. And the one point I've always made as I go through this book and try and summarize what I'm learning from these things is whether or not we believe in a doctrine of reincarnation. There's an awful lot of scientific evidence. You probably have heard of quantum physics. A lot of people have been using quantum physics to kind of work around the topic of the law of attraction from The Secret and some of the things that were put into that movie that were a little more hokey sounding and from the book of the same name. And a lot of the things that were left out of The Secret, both the book and the movie. And people are starting now to use quantum physics, and the whole idea of quantum physics, to kind of lend a little credibility to what's in The Secret. And if you look at it not from that aspect, but if you look at it from just trying to understand where we find ourselves in the world, quantum physics actually starts to make a whole ton of sense. And it doesn't necessarily lend credibility to the idea of reincarnation either. But one of the key points with quantum physics, one of the key points is something called a zero-point field. And if I understand that correctly, and I don't understand all the calculus and whatnot, but if I understand the idea correctly behind the zero-point field, the gist of it is that if we work everything out mathematically and run the formulas, there comes a condition where everything and everywhere and every when are all in the exact same place at the exact same time. And if we learn to manipulate those conditions, we can jump from dimension to dimension. We can jump from time to time. We can jump from space to space. We can jump from consciousness to consciousness. And we can jump from any of those to any of the others, or any combination of any of them, because with the zero-point field, everything is all in one place. That's the one condition in the physics realm where we can literally occupy more than one space at a time. And it's only in that particular context. So when you hear a phrase like, the master had learnings from other lands and other schools, other lives that he had lived, don't let that throw you. I know a number of people who just completely turn off of that because of the whole idea of reincarnation, that they don't want to be any part of that, or whatever the case is. But understand, there is some scientific evidence and some mathematical proofs behind the concept that Richard is talking here. And one of the notes that I pick up from reading that paragraph is remembering our other lives, our other situations, and remembering those lessons that we've learned there. And it's only through remembering and applying that we can truly become wise and truly become strong. And another thought just occurs to me now. When you hear the phrase other lives, it's not necessarily a reincarnation thing. For example, 20 years ago I was in the military for a few years. That was my life then. That was another life that I lived. 15 years ago I was at a certain job in California. That was my life then. Now my life involves me working at a specific job in Colorado and starting a podcast and starting a number of other side projects. So I think if you look at the phrase other lives, it doesn't necessarily also have to mean reincarnation or quantum physics or zero point fields. But if you just put it in context of all your experiences from the first day until now, that might be a very good way to look at it. Now taking a look at the clock, we are coming up on the time that I wanted to go ahead and stop. I wanted to keep all these episodes fairly short, say 15 minutes or less, whenever possible. Might spill over just a teeny bit longer than that in some cases, but I really wanted to try and keep the 15 minutes or less and honor your time and honor your time commitment. And then that also gives us a chance to explore the book in smaller chunks, which I have found will be really, really worthwhile. going through, there's just so much richness contained in here. So I don't want to try and cram too much all at once. And you know what? We've hit the 15-minute mark, so I'm going to go ahead and sign off for this episode. Thank you so much for joining the Illusions podcast. And we'll see you next time in about a week. Take care now. Bye.